from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Royteam.
Good morning. It is Thursday, July 29th. Thank you so much for joining us on the G and Ursula Show. G is off today. He will be back tomorrow. Aaron Mason is filling in. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Ursula.
So, still ahead, one of our top stories is that deadly shooting in Pierce County, and the sheriff's spokesman had said to Cairo TV that they were not able to use the search dog because of new laws that went into effect, and you and I discussed that in the top five stories, and we said we were trying to get a hold of someone from the Pierce County Sheriff's Department, and we will get Sergeant Darren Moss coming up at 10:33 so we can ask those questions and learn some more. But right now, we want to jump right in because we have a lot going on in our three things that you need to know at 10.
Number one.
So if you woke up early this morning, you may have heard that there was an 8.2 earthquake that shook the Aleutian Islands off Alaska. Tsunami warnings were canceled within a couple of hours, but we were wondering, did anyone on the coast or near one of our states knew 50 tsunami sirens wake up? Ready to head for the hills? And I ask that because I realize that if we have a big earthquake, which we know that that is something that is basically predicted at some point in time, given our geographic location, after the 2001 Nisqually earthquake, the big one that we had here, I promised that I was going to get everything prepared. And I got a lot of things prepared, but I haven't done anything to update it since then.
That go bag is still sitting from 2001.
Yeah, 20 years later, I'm thinking it might be time to update the snacks. And maybe
water probably needs a refresh.
Yeah. What about you? Do you when you hear an earthquake, do you think I got to get myself prepared?
I do, and then I don't do anything about it. Oh, I'll get to it later. You know, I'll get to it when I get to it. But I live on the third floor, the top floor of a brick apartment building. Like a very old building. And if there was a bad earthquake, I'd be pretty toast and really do need to like get something done. My girlfriend, of course, because she's better than me in every way, apparently, has a bag. She's ready to roll. She's fine for it.
You can share your girlfriend's
bag. I'll steal her water.
I think when I still had young kids at home.
Yeah.
Right. And it was something that I wanted to make sure, hey, I got to make sure that we will be able to suffice on our own, figure out how to survive on our own if we had to go a couple of days without water, et cetera, et cetera. I share all this because it's a good reminder. And so often we wait until we are in that disastrous situation where we're like,
Now, I don't know. I'm not out on the coast. I don't know what the tsunami plan is. I hope that if you do live out there, you at least have an idea what road to take, et cetera.
Yeah, one of the things that Chef told us is that when he was out on, was it the coast, I believe, he was talking about the tsunami warnings going off, the sirens going off, and it was really hard to hear. I think there are some kinks that still need to be worked out.
Yeah.
Because it was hard to hear, and if you don't know what that is, and if you haven't done the drills, I think that there's room to, hey, we need to do more of these drills, not just keep talking
about
it.
Are there drills? I've been here for 21 years. I've never done an earthquake drill.
We have that earthquake drill. Yeah. I mean, we are one of the stations that people have to turn to for information. So we have that designation that we are a station that, so for that reason, we have to do the earthquake drills. We have to air the tone that lets people
know. The emergency
know
broadcasting system test and all that.
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, good reminder. If you didn't hear about the thing in Alaska and it's just use this as your sign that, hey, we need to get prepared.
Have some plan.
Absolutely.
Number two.
So schools are going to be reopening in just over a month. And with COVID cases and hospitalizations going up again, what can students and their parents expect this fall? We know this is a really important question for so many of you. I should include teachers and staff as well. Mm-hmm. So we have invited State School Superintendent Chris Rakedahl to join us now. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for always joining us. And I can't tell you how much we appreciate that whether it's for situations like this or talking about tough topics, that you are always so willing to come on and talk, and that is really appreciated. So let's talk about some of the credible scenarios that you're looking at for this fall based on what we know right now, the guidance going out, the modeling that you've gotten from public health officers. Are you expecting to be still fully in person this fall?
Yes. Our direction to districts is that we are going to provide a fully in-person 5-day-a-week option for every single family and student who wants it. The May part is districts may provide a remote option for the families who want that. But we're not going to make this decision this year that we're going remote. We are going to be in person. It won't look like it did 3 years ago or 2 years ago, but a little more like last spring, where students are still going to have to wear face coverings as well as staff. The governor just reiterated that yesterday. Obviously, we hope by now we could start giving some choice to families about that. But this Delta variant is, quite frankly, a very different beast than we saw in the earlier variants.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. How exactly does this Delta variant change things?
I think what we were seeing in the epidemiological curves was a reduction in cases, therefore reduction in hospitalizations, reductions in mortality in the state under the earlier ones. So we could really model this notion that we'd come back this fall, maybe only require masks for those who are unvaccinated, or even give families the ability to kind of opt out, because we would expect that we were close to this herd immunity concept. This is so different. Based on studies in Israel, England, and at least one study in the United States now, students are big carriers of this variant. Thankfully, still not getting really sick, but more of them are getting sick. More young people are being hospitalized, but they're carrying it like any adult would, and therefore they're shedding virus and infecting others. That's why we got to stick with masks for a bit longer.
Chris, are you expecting any kind of pushback as far as going back fully in person from the unions, the teachers' union?
Well, I think each local district has its own relationship. What they have to do is follow the law. And both the law of how we budget and the governor's proclamations and orders have the power of law. And so we expect that they're going to fully come back. Now, the best thing about this year compared to last year is every adult has a chance to vaccinate. And we think those numbers are really high for our adults in our schools. All of our students over the age of 12 have had a chance to vaccinate. So not only are we vaccinated at higher levels and we're masking this fall, along with our other mitigation strategies, it will be a very safe and a very healthy opening. But they got to work through that, and they got to make sure that they really believe in the safety protocols that are in place in each district.
We're starting to see mandates or requirements, vaccine requirements, both for government workplaces and private businesses. Do you think public school employees should be required to be vaccinated?
I do, but that's a decision that's going to come from the governor ultimately on the adults, on the employees in schools. The student vaccine requirement actually comes through our state board of health following a long process with the feds. So we don't expect that this year at all for students. We don't expect that there's any mandate for vaccine for students this year, even the ones who are currently eligible. But it is within the legal authority of governors and across the country to require public employees to vaccinate or go through routine testing if they choose not to vaccinate. And I do think that would be appropriate given the public health crisis we face today.
Chris, you know that one of the state's highest paid employees, a coach from Washington State University, the football coach, has opted not to. We don't know the reasoning behind it, but there are people who support him in that, and then there are people who say he should be fired. You are in the camp of you think that public school employees should be required to get vaccinated. What is your argument for that?
Well, again, it's a public health emergency, and there are lots of professions where you have to vaccinate as a condition of employment. And while we typically think of those as internal medicine and other high-risk work, this thing was so deadly to people. We've lost over 600,000 American lives, over 6,000 Washingtonians, that it just compels us to be at a higher level of safety. And I think it's not inappropriate. Now, anytime I say I believe in mandatory vaccines, you got to know that I believe in an individual's right to have an option out of that. And in this case, what you see coming now from the federal government and others is that employees will be required to test routinely if they're not going to vaccinate, which is their right. they have to go through aggressive, regular testing, and that would be an appropriate response. I wish that coach at WHU would show some more leadership and do this based on the science. If he has another reason, I certainly understand that, and I wish he would express it. But unfortunately, when public leaders and high-paid leaders don't explain their reasoning and take an action in violation of the obvious science, it empowers other people to believe the misinformation. And that's what's frustrating about that, is the lack of transparency.
Chris, one of the things that you talked about early in the pandemic when we were talking about how to make sure that kids have access to education is that so many students, especially in lower income neighborhoods, did not have access to computers. Are we better prepared for that? Should we be in a position where they would have to go remote?
Yeah, we really are. By the time we got through about the middle of last year, we had deployed over 300,000 devices to those who didn't have it. So we really closed, almost eliminated that hardware gap. We still can't close the connectivity gap because there are places that are just absolute deserts for high speed. So it is still not an equitable environment. It's why I'm working so hard to make sure our schools are open for every family who wants it. But let's face it, if we had to go through that again, which I don't expect, we are significantly more prepared than we were a year ago.
That's great news. Chris, we as a show are really working hard, and it is very hard, let me tell you, to try to work through the misinformation. And this is a statement that we have from one of our state representatives, Newhouse, who is calling on the governor to believe in science, this is a quote, and stop discouraging, wait a minute. So he said, so Governor Inslee has once again, this is a quote, he has once again hastily and ignored science by mandating mask wearing for teachers and students for a school year that is weeks away from beginning. Not only are children at decreased risk of COVID-19, but they have already experienced a year and a half of devastating losses in learning and critical effects on their mental and emotional health. That is a quote. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of ideology out there, and people use terms very loosely. So the science in this case is whether or not a sneeze or a cough can escape the immediate radius of your body and infect others. And obviously, what Department of Health has, if you go to their website, doh.wa.gov, and tons of researchers from around the world will tell you that a face covering significantly reduces the volume of droplets that leave your person and potentially infect others. It's a no-brainer. Masks create more safety. They're not perfect, though. So from a health standpoint, the science is very clear about masking and distancing. The learning loss is not inappropriate to bring up. It looks like it's about 3 or 4 months on average out of about 150 months of learning for students from kindergarten to 12th grade. There's about a 3 or 4 month slip here that we have to make sure we reaccelerate. So obviously we put in resources to do that. We're really focused on reading and math. We know we can catch up. We had unprecedented summer programs, so we're very aware of that, and we're mitigating that as much as we can. But from a science standpoint, it's just absolutely inappropriate to claim that masking is not part of the layered strategy for public safety and public health.
You said that kids do spread this variant, and so I just want to ask again, is there any chance that you'll have to shift positions and encourage full remote learning or short-term shutdowns for schools if outbreaks occur?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really good question. We don't anticipate any full shutdowns at all. Again, a year ago, we didn't have anyone vaccinated. Now we've got this huge percentage of folks in most counties. Some are still lagging. We have a lot of our middle school and high school students who have vaccinated, and that number continues to grow. So we don't expect to have to do any kind of shutdowns. The irony is, if we don't get more people vaccinated and we don't mask up, what you will see, as you just described, Aaron, is this reality that we'll have quarantining. We will have more outbreaks, and therefore students will have to be dismissed for 10 to 14 days, immediately hit that switch and jump to remote learning. It'll be very disruptive to learning. The best thing we can do to keep schools open, keep everyone there in person, and to have the continuity of learning and recovery of learning is to get vaccinated if you're eligible, to wear your face covering, everybody. That's what avoids the disruptions and the needs for parents to go find, you know, childcare for 2 weeks at a time, every 6 to 8 weeks on an outbreak. So together, we actually do things that help each other. That's that sense of common good that I think is being lost in all of the talking points and all of the rhetoric that we see coming at us just about every day now.
That is Chris Rakedahl, State School Superintendent. We thank you so much for your time and appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Ursula. Thank you, Aaron. Take care.
You too. Okay, coming up, still ahead, we are going to be talking about
Sergeant Darren Moss.
Oh, that's right. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
Pierce
right.
County
Absolutely. I'm sorry. We're switching gears. Absolutely. Because we found out that we are going to get a chance to ask him some questions. I just said that. Because we had questions about this, the new laws,
the new,
and
yeah.
how it's affecting police in real time. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to help us understand that. You are listening to the G and Ursula Show. The G and Ursula Show. G is off today. Aaron Mason is filling in. And one of our top stories has been this shooting death in Pierce County, where deputies are now searching for a suspect after a man was found dead in a Kohl's parking lot. Deputies were called to a report of a shooting in Puyallup last night. And when they arrived, they found the victim deceased in that parking lot. And there was something about the story that we discussed, and it was that because of new police accountability laws that went into effect, the spokesman for the Pierce County Sheriff's Department said they were not able to track with a canine. So we have invited Sergeant Darren Moss with the Sheriff's Department to join us now on the G and Ursula Show. Good morning, Sergeant.
Good morning, Ursula. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. This is the first time we get a chance to talk to you as spokesman, so we appreciate you joining us. So explain, first of all, let's just go back to what we know about this particular case.
Yeah, so it was 10:20 p.m., and we got a call of shots fired at the Kohl's. As deputies were headed there, then they heard that there was a person down on the ground. So when they got there, the deputies saw the victim and knew the person was deceased. And the only description we had was a person in dark clothing, dark shirt, dark pants. So just based off that initial 911 call, we know that there was a shooting. We know that somebody committed a murder, but who is that person? The description of somebody in dark clothes just gives us reasonable suspicion, but it doesn't give us probable cause yet. So our deputies, tried to check in the area to see if anybody matching the description they could see. One of our canine officers was there to assist. He did search as well, but he did not use his canine partner due to the risk of not having probable cause, which would not give him reason to use force in this situation. And some people have talked about, well, I don't want you to bite the wrong person with the dog when you're searching for the bad guy. But we're not talking about biting the wrong person. We're talking about biting the person that committed the murder. We can't bite him because we don't have probable cause yet.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because for a lot of people, they might not even understand. You used to work under the premise that a reasonable suspicion was enough, and now with these new laws that went into effect Sunday, you have to prove probable cause. What would you have done in the same case before Sunday?
In the same case before Sunday, with reasonable suspicion, anyone within the area, within reason, so I can't walk 2 miles down the road in the first 5 seconds of the call looking for the person, that would be unreasonable. I can't do a 2 mile radius search and just bite somebody 2 miles away. But somebody within the vicinity of the crime that matches that description, we would track. And if we saw that person, we'd be allowed to detain them. Now, if that person refused to comply, we would be able to use force, reasonable amount of force. So if that person is hiding in the bushes, and we believe they just shot and killed someone, I don't think any deputy wants to have to go into the bushes blindly and grab this person and pull them out. And that's where a canine is awfully helpful. But in this instance last night, we didn't have a good idea where the person was, but we could have used a canine to track his scent. But then the issue becomes when you track to the spot where the suspect is, and he's not going to come out, and we can't go in with the dog. Or if the dog is on lead and he starts tracking through the brush and finds the guy and immediately goes on contact, now we bit somebody without probable cause, even if it's the homicide suspect.
So, Sergeant Moss,
are you violating the law?
Okay, and I understand. So you're saying that that whole thought process, have you been told we cannot use canine? Or because obviously you brought him. So did that whole thought process actually go through before saying, nah, we can't use it? In this case?
I mean, it's not something that we're used to. So it's only been this the first week. And so when deputies get on scene, they really have to stop and think and say, okay, let's slow down, which is what we should do anyway. Mm-hmm. But the problem is we're limiting what tools and what resources and how we're able to affect arrests on the actual suspects. We're limiting the fact that we're not going to be able to pursue people until we have a lot more information in the investigation. So in essence, you're taking away what is called a Terry stop, mm-hmm. Which is used throughout the whole country. It's case law that gives us reasonable suspicion is okay to try to apprehend suspects until you can investigate and determine whether they are the person that did it or not.
Sergeant.
So the canine officer, when he gets there, the initial urge is to let the canine out. Let's go find this guy. But we have to stop and think, okay, but when I find him or if my dog finds him before I see him and the dog bites him, now I'm violating the law. So maybe we don't need to use the canine yet until we get probable cause.
So, Sergeant, it sounds to me from my perspective that there are some new rules that have been decided and passed into law and that you've got a situation where there was a murder. Someone is dead on the ground, and understanding again from my side that okay, this is sort of an attempt to change the rules so that things work out better for both sides involved. That law enforcement can still get their job done, but maybe in a way that's more appropriate, or however you want to define that. Mm-hmm. Why is it such a big deal that you've got a victim, a dead body on the ground? You think you may have a suspect in the area. Is there any wiggle room as you try and implement these big overarching decisions into the detailed nitty gritty of your everyday police work?
Is there wiggle room outside of the law? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm saying, do you think that you would be able to defend the decision of sending a canine officer searching for a murder suspect?
Can I actually just say, do you think that you would have been breaking the law if you had sent the canine in this case to find someone who was wearing dark clothing? Maybe we need to understand better how would the canine help in this particular case.
That is 100%. And that's the thing that people don't understand. Probable cause means I have enough to say that this person did this crime. With just a description of clothing, all I have is that a person matching this description, I could reasonably believe may have been involved in that crime. And if you saw somebody behind the Big Five in the parking lot matching that description, and you took him down on the ground and handcuffed him, or you told him to stop, he turns around, complies, and you handcuff him, that would be very reasonable to say, well, this guy's got dark clothes on. He's around the corner from this homicide, and this is where the suspect ran to. That's reasonable. But we're not talking about what's reasonable. We're talking about probable cause. Is this the person that committed the crime, or is there enough of a description to say that we're over 51% sure that this is the one that did it? So if the guy was wearing a Barney the Dinosaur helmet, and you see a guy wearing a Barney the Dinosaur helmet around the corner, that gives me a little bit more. That's a pretty good probable cause because it's such a good description. If I have the license plate of a getaway vehicle, I've got probable cause to stop that vehicle. I don't know who I have probable cause to arrest in the vehicle yet, but if it's a shooting, a drive-by shooting kind of thing, now I have probable cause to at least detain them and try to figure it out, because both of them are involved. One is the driver and one is the shooter, or they're both witness to it or suspect to it. But the thing that I think people are losing track of with all these changes is these two things about where they added probable cause might sound good for a lower level crime. A shoplift. You should make sure you know this is your shoplift suspect before you tackle him or use force against him. But does that apply for a homicide? The thing I want people to think about is our victim is a teenage boy. He's not a grown man. He's not an adult. He is dead right now. And his family, what are they thinking about? What would they have wanted us or anyone else to do that night to try to catch the person that killed their little boy? And if the rules that we've put in place hinder us where we would, it's very reasonable for, like I said, the guy in dark clothing around the corner, who when we see him, he runs at the scene of a homicide, it's reasonable to think that he could be involved and try to catch him to make sure that's not our homicide suspect. But now we don't know if that track would have helped catch this person. And for this boy's family, I feel sorry for him. Mm-hmm. Our officers did not get in trouble last night. They did not get punished. The family of this young man is the ones that got punished because we weren't able to do what we would have been doing in the past. Not saying we would have definitely caught the person, but we didn't even get the chance to try.
So
That's heartbreaking for law enforcement officers with these changes.
I hear you. So I know that a bunch of sheriffs and police chiefs are asking for clarification on these laws. My understanding was that there were law enforcement folks who were part of the crafting of these bills. And so now, you know, I think for some, it's the concern is your hands are too tight. And, you know, that's not what we want. And you're absolutely right. The community and the boy's family in particular would want the killer to be caught. But can that be done without, you know, while still using a canine? That to me sounds crazy.
How,
Sergeant, you can't use a dog in the search.
How do you deploy a canine officer to find somebody in dark clothing around the corner?
They have a 30-foot lead, I believe, a very, very long lead. So if we're out in a public space, the dog does not get released to just run willy-nilly. And the officer has control of the dog. The officer gives commands when they do contact someone to try to have them come out. But like I said, the issue is if you're going through brush or a wooded area and the dog is tracking and the dog, we give announcements when we're searching a building or searching an area where we think the person might be in the woods, telling them, you know, come on out. We have a canine. You will be bit if you don't comply.
Right.
But unfortunately, none of that matters anymore because we don't have probable cause. So the bite, whether it's on the right person, doesn't matter. We don't have probable cause to bite anyone, even the correct suspect. So unless we get more information to say it was Joe Smith, he's wearing a purple hat, black shirt, black pants, and he's hiding behind, even with the description and the name, I don't know what Joe Smith looks like.
Yeah.
If I can pull up his picture and then I see Joe Smith, now I have probable cause. But just even if I have a name and a description, and I don't know what that person looks like, I mean, it's still down to a person wearing dark clothes somewhere out in the
right. And certainly in the heat of the moment, you don't have all these different steps. I mean, every second is vital, and I get that. And you don't have all these minutes to go through the whole process. So I completely understand. We are way long on time right now. Sergeant, I appreciate you joining us. This is something that we're going to continue to try. There is a lot of talk that from and I want to say both sides, all sides, in terms of we want to get to the bottom of this. How you've described it, it sounds like an impossible situation. I'm just getting a text message from a captain from SPD who says, yes, they would be breaking the law. And he talks about an armed robbery suspect who ran away because while he matched the suspect description, they did not have probable cause to arrest. They only had reasonable suspicion. So these are actual legal terms and standards that we must abide by now. And it sounds like it's much more complicated. We will continue to try to understand more. And we are going to talk to the lawmakers who are behind this. I can't imagine that that was the intent. So we appreciate your time, Sergeant Moss. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant.
All right. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, still ahead, we're going to do an abbreviated scenario. So you are listening to the G and Ursula Show. It is now 10:51. We're going to have an abbreviated version of scenarios, and it's brought to you by Farrah.com.
Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo.
All right, let's zip through this fast. Dear G, Ursula, and Chef, I have a very dear friend I've known since grade school. We both have teen girls, and I consider her 16-year-old to be a kind of second daughter. My daughter calls my friend her second mom. The pandemic opened a crack in our relationship, though. She does not believe in getting herself or her family vaccinated and forbade her daughter from doing so. We argue about it a couple times, and I gave up trying to convince her. Well, her daughter must have overheard us talking, because she texted me out of the blue asking if I would take her to a local pharmacy to get the vaccine. She said she was really scared about going back to school in the fall and needed someone to pretend to be her parent at the appointment. After hesitating, I agreed and took her. She made the appointment. I just drove her. We live in a rural area, and she also doesn't have her license. Well, my friend found out, and she's livid. She's forbidden me from ever seeing her daughter again. She's 16, by the way, in case I didn't mention. I feel terrible at betraying my friend, but also feel like I did the right thing. What should I do to save my friendship? Or did I do the wrong thing?
Yeah, you did the wrong thing. Even though you may think that you're her second mom, you are not her mom. And I would be livid if someone brought my child somewhere without my knowing to do something. Even in this case, I agree with vaccination, and I see Aaron standing up, but I agree with vaccination. I am not going to take over someone's child and someone's parenting and do that. The only way I would do that is if I thought she was like in imminent danger, and even that I would totally talk to the parent first. I can't even think of any scenario where I would take someone and do it without the parent knowing. No. And I would be beyond livid if someone did that to me.
Going back to school is imminent danger. Absolutely, you did the right thing because mommy's a dum-dum. And I think you are absolutely old enough at 16 to make a decision like this for yourself. Now, maybe there are some hurdles. You can't sign the paperwork because you need an adult to do that. But I think 16 is perfectly old enough to be able to start taking control of your health. It's your body. And this is something that is very important to her. She went to an adult that was like a parent to her and said, I need help. Will you help me? My mom doesn't want me to have this thing, but I want it. I think absolutely she should be able to get that. And if she needs someone to come in and say, I'm your mom, then good on her.
To muddy the waters even further.
Oh, God, no.
The Department of Health says that 16, 17-year-olds do need parental consent. But we also have a doctrine in the state called the Mature Minor Doctrine that allows them to receive immunizations without consent. So it feels like we have this very debate going on within our laws as well with this particular vaccine.
So then she just needed a ride. That's all. I'm fine with that. 100%.
Then find a ride from someone else other than your friend when you know. No.
She lives in the country. Is she going to Uber?
I feel like that is a betrayal of the friendship, too. I would work my influence and try to convince the mother, you know what? You don't agree with it, but your daughter is old enough to know what she wants with her body. I will take her. I will do it, but don't do it around her back.
Would you be okay having her daughter take the friend?
No, I don't agree with anyone doing something against the wishes of the parent. Period.
But what if the parent's wrong? I mean, what if it's a different situation?
Then work it through. No, you talked about this situation. This is this scenario. Okay. Agree to disagree is next. You are listening to the G and Ursula Show.